And this is how I want you to make the bed. And I give her instructions on how to do it. And I do that. And the limits and standards. Suzanne, when you get up in the morning, Dad comes in here and flicks on the light and says, "Ta-da! Get out of the rack, daughter." It means you get up, you go to the potty. As soon as you're done with the potty, you come back in here and make the bed. Every day. Every day. That's exactly how you do it. And then my part of the enforcement is every morning when we're going down to breakfast, I go by the rooms. Check them out. That's my part of it. To make sure she's made her bed. To help her with it. Every day. So when I'm home, that's my routine. Time for breakfast, I'm going down, checking the rack. Just like boot camp. Teach them how to make the bed. Now, when they're three, you know, they can't handle a great big heavy bedspread and a big heavy blanket and all that. No, no. We make it real easy when they're young. They just pull the sheet up because that's all they've got on it. We take the blanket off. They pull the sheet up, get it straightened out, and put the pillows on. And what I'm trying to do is develop that pattern in their lives. And as you get a little older, you learn how to handle the bedspread. You say, "Now look, kids, you see the bedspread? See, it's got these checks on it. Now here's the edge of the bed, see? We count up from the bottom. 11 blocks. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Now the 11th block is right on there all the way down. And that's exactly how we do it. And when I go in there and check that bed, boy, I go 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. They know that's what they're supposed to do, and that's what they want to do. They want me to be faithful to check them out. Or say it's the task of carrying out the trash. Carry out the trash every morning. Take it out and dump in the trash can. Also part of carrying out the trash is to hold the trash around the trash can. Not just the trash in there. So that means you pick up the trash off the floor and put it in the trash can. And you come now with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of little things that you're going to want to teach your kids. And you can use this little deal, at least we do, and go right through it. Whether it's hanging up the clothes in the closet, and at, you know, 3 or 4 years old, they can hang up clothes in the closet. All it means is they pull a chair over and stand up on a chair and stick it out. They can pick up their toys. You know, multitude of little things. Saves Mama all kinds of energy. Really does. Okay, another way I use this for the kids. Honor thy parents. How do you practically get that across? I was talking with a Jewess a while back in one of the dormitories. She was giving me a hard time. We were surveying the students. She was really giving me fits. So, young lady, let me talk to you about the book of Exodus. She was in a religion class. And in the book of Exodus, when God laid down the commandments, he said, "Honor thy father and thy mother." Now, I would like you, because you're a Jew, you tell me how you're going to do that. Because you're 20-some-odd years old. You got a mom and dad. How are you practically honoring your parents? What are the dynamics involved? And she couldn't tell me. She hummed and hawed around, but she couldn't practically talk about how she was going to honor her parents. So, well, let me give you an idea. So I gave her this. First thing God expects you to do in terms of honoring your parents is to obey them when you're children. Children obey your parents and the Lord. I said, when you're economically dependent upon your mom and dad, obey them. When you're financially independent, you're on your own, counsel with them. You don't have to do what they say, but counsel with them. You've got to be a good counselor for your children. When your children leave you, that's another role that you begin to assume, as a counselor with them. I said, then when your mom and dad are real old, care for them. Don't dump them on the government. And don't dump them in some old folks' home. Now that's a little Lewisology there. I'm really hung on that minute. Your mom and dad brought you into the world, and your mom and dad poured out blood, sweat, and tears to get you going. And we're living in an age right now when mom and dad are on the way out, we dump them. We don't want to take some of the blood, sweat, and tears that were invested in us and then invest it in them on their way out. I'll give you a personal one. My grandmother's 95, the one from Norway. She's living in a high-rise for elderly people right now. My uncle's still alive. He's responsible for it. He wants a dumper in an old folks' home.
So I flew through town this summer, and I asked my grandmother to come and live with me. Grandma, come and live with me. All she didn't want to do. In 95, she'd be a problem and all that sort of stuff. So I said, well, let me talk to your son. So I call him Uncle Up. Uncle, I understand you're going to dump Grandma in an old folks home. Yeah, you know, Dolly. I said, well, I want her. I want to take her home with me. Pause. She wets her pants, then she takes them off and hides them. You take her home, you got to take care of all that. I wet my pants when I was little and took care of me. You got to figure out where to bury her. I mean, those are real earth-shaking problems, aren't they? It'll inconvenience my lifestyle if I move her in with me. So what? That's part of life, isn't it? Here's the principle of life. Chickens always come home to roost. Always. And the way you treat your mom and dad on their way out, your kids will treat you in a similar fashion. You reap what you sow. And the last one, cultivate. From the day my children are aware of their responsibility in terms of a relationship, they have to be committed to cultivating that relationship with me just as much as I have to work at cultivating my relationship with them. In a relationship, an interpersonal relationship, is dynamic. It's always growing. It never stops. We never arrive. So from the beginning, we have to work at it, work at it, work at it, work at it. So if you want to honor your mom and dad, work at cultivating your relationship with them. Teach your kids the same thing. But that's how I use that little idea on the training box for the kids. I use the same thing. My boy came home from school a while back. Daddy said, Billy ripped off my pencil, ballpoint pencil. I said, what'd you do about it? I went and told the teacher. Well, what'd she say? She said, Andrew, I don't get involved in those kind of things. You work it out. Okay? So, really, dear teacher, my wife hates my letter writing. And the thrust of my letter was, I don't like the value system you're inculcating in my boy. I want to take issue with it. So rather than send the letter, I went up there to talk to her. She said, Mr. Lewis, we do not teach values in this school. I said, my good woman, you teach values in this school. No, we don't. I said, well, Andrew said, thus and so happened, and this is what he did, and this is what you said. Is that correct? That's correct. I said, you're teaching my son values. What are the options available to Andrew? He said, Andrew, work it out. All right? Andrew can embrace a philosophy that might makes right, and he can go beat the living daylights out of Billy and get his pen. You want him to do that? Oh, no. But that's an option you gave him. Or he can go muster a bunch of other guys, and they can go beat the living daylights out of Billy and get that pen. That's vigilante law, and that's what the country's coming to. Should Andrew do that? Oh, no. So she said, well, what would you suggest? So I gave her some suggestions. She said, would you come up and teach values in the school? So I went up and taught values to the fourth graders. And I used this with those fourth graders. And I built it around the idea of rights and responsibilities. For every right you have a commensurate responsibility. And I use this as an illustration. I'm an aviator, so I took one of my models up there, a model I had in the Marine Corps. I said, kids, let's pretend, and I showed it to them, we talked about it, and I threw it on the ground. I said, let's pretend now we're done, and we're all going to go home, and I forget my model. And then I knew who the bully was, so I singled him out and said, hey, Billy, let's say you find it, and I'm gone. Whose is it? He said, mine. And I said, why is it yours? And he said, finders keepers, losers weepers. And they all yucked it up and laughed. It was funny. I said, is that really true? Did I give it to you? Oh, no, sir. Then it's not yours, is it? It's always mine until I give it away. Just like it's always yours if it belongs to you. Unless you give it away. If you find it, you should find out who it belongs to. Because you want other people to do the same thing to you. For every right you have a responsibility. You like the right to not being ridiculed because of your personal looks, then you defend other people. If you don't defend them, you don't have a right. And you can use that little deal to get that to the kids. Now, let me read you something. Each day as I face my classes, I remember my bar mitzvah day, the day I came into my ethical inheritance. Before a packed congregation, I was presented with the rights of manhood. I had to accept these rights in a speech written not by me nor by my elders, but by tradition. I stood up and in a changing voice read aloud, "I now have the right to do right, to do justice, to do good, to serve humanity, to help the needy, to heal the sick, to look after my country, to strive for peace, to seek after truth, to fight oppression, to liberate all mankind from bondage." As I read on, I realized I'd been taken. What rights? These rights were really obligations, commitments, responsibilities. I began to catch on. My rights and my obligations not only became inseparable, but together formed a moral mandate. What tradition was telling me was that responsibilities exercised by all guaranteed the rights of all. We have to get that across to our kids. God expects us to make our way through humanity. God expects us to make our way through humanity, honoring Him, serving humanity, being responsible. And half our problem, more than half our problems today, are problems just because men and women like you and me will not be responsible. There's a building in Philadelphia where some people are trying to work with children, and on the wall it says this: "Don't look, or you'll see. And don't listen, or you'll hear." And then when people start to tell you what the problem is, you say, "I didn't hear. I didn't see." And that's what happens with most of us. We don't want to see. We don't want to hear. We get involved in other things. Our process is to encourage our kids, teach them by precept and practice, and then we warn them, or we punish them, part of our warning. This enforcement aspect, we're going to run out of time. There are three ways in which I enforce: lift, lash, and limit. Lift, lash, and limit. The greatest motivator is praise. Praise. So in terms of the lip, I motivate my kids with praise. I let them know that they have pleased me, that I'm happy with their performance, the way they're carrying themselves. If that doesn't get the result in terms of their consistent conduct, then I go to verbal rebuke. And if verbal rebuke won't affect the result, then I go to the rod. Then I go to the lash. And there are generally three areas in which I end up with the lash. One is disobedience. The second one is disrespect. And the third one is irresponsible conduct. Disobedience, disrespect, and irresponsible conduct. Now, when they get older, their teenagers are, you know, well into their teens, it's no longer the lash, the rod, then it becomes limits. I begin to restrict them. And their infractions then begin to cost them something that's very precious to them. My daughter's a majorette, and that would be one restriction I would use there. I had a little difficulty with her this fall, and so one of my restrictions was I just limited her participation as a majorette. And that was a real costly experience for her. So I wasn't going to say, "Well, Amy, I'll take away 5 cents. It wouldn't cost." So that's how I use the limits on the teens. I think my oldest boy is in the Navy right now. The last time I gave him a spanking, he was 14. And he'd shown disrespect to his mother. First time I talked to him about it, it didn't work. I was on a trip like this, and he did it again. And I came home, and my wife told me how he'd just been sort of, you know, feeling his oats, you know, and sort of throwing his weight around, getting kind of big. So I walked to his room. He was in his room studying. I knocked on the door. He came out, stood in the hallway there. I said, "Son, Mom told me thus and so and thus and so, and you did that, right?" "Yes, sir." A little cocky tone to his voice. So I grabbed him by his coat, just like this, threw him up against the wall, and I held him against the wall. And I said, "Young man, anybody anybody messes with my wife like you've done gets poked right in the nose. Nobody messes with my wife. She's my wife first, she's your mother second, and you'd never horse around with her like that. Now, you are going to get licked. The next time, you're going to get punched right in the nose. Into the garage. Took him in the garage, bent his rear end over the workbench with his mother standing there, administered four good sound swats with a board. He was crying, she was crying, and I was crying. Well, I got my point across. He never did that again. I told him, I said, son, I hope to God that you honor your wife and that you have the same kind of attitude toward your wife. But I want you to know, son, that you are not going to treat that woman that way. She's my wife, and she's a woman I intend to spend the rest of my life with, and you are not going to treat her with disrespect, without ruffled by feathers. So he's a good boy. But that's the last time he got licked, and he was 14. He's almost as big as me then. He's as big as me now. So that's enforcement. Enforcement is extremely important. You need to establish a sense of justice in the minds of your kids. Ecclesiastes 8:11 says, when you don't execute sentence against an evil work speedily, the hearts of the sons of men are fully set in them to do evil. That's why it's important for me every morning when I go down to breakfast to walk by those rooms and to see that those beds are made, that those rooms are straightened up. Because I want to be able to move in swiftly and correct it right away, rather than let it go on and on and on. I have a little principle we operate by, and that is I never let my children develop a habit we have to break later. One would be the habit of irresponsibility. Society has a beautiful way of busting that one. So I don't want the kids to develop that. But there are many ways in which I apply that. And let me quickly give you one other thing. I call this Lewis's Laws of Child Raising. Because for me, they're laws. Number one, children must be taught to obey. They must be taught to obey. Your voice, your look, and your spirit. Number two, the will of the child is the key to the process. It must be yielded to you. I can't emphasize that one enough. If you want to do a good job of your children, you get them to yield their will to you early. It'll be so much easier for them and so much easier for you. And by early, that might mean 4 or 5 months, 7 months, whenever you can define an issue of will and you're communicating with them. They know the issue. Then you must get them to yield. I'll give you an illustration. At 7 months, I was feeding my daughter, Suzanne. We were down in the kitchen. I had one of those little warmers, you know, a little dish that was plugged in the wall. Keep her food warm. Starts feeding her, and she reached out and she grabbed the cord. She started to pull the cord. And I said, Suzanne, no, no, no. Took her hand off. Feed her again, and she just looked at me, and she had that little kind of a fiery look in her eye. She just reached over there real quickly again, and I took her hand, and I said, Suzanne, no, do not touch the cord, no. And she went, ooh, and grabbed it again. I took that little old hand, I went, whammo. I said, do not touch the cord. And she looked right at me, and just as proud as could be, she went, took it again. And I went, whammo again. And I said, Daddy said, do not touch the cord. And she pulled her hand back and she just looked at me. I began to feed her some more. And she started to stick her hand out as if she was going to take that cord. And I looked at her and I said, Suzanne, no. And she stopped midway with her hand open as if she still wanted to touch that cord, but she didn't. And she looked at me again. And I said, Suzanne, good, very good. We continued our feeding,
Some moments later, she started again. She went to reach for the cord, and I said, "Suzanne, no." And she stopped. And I again said, "Suzanne, very good, very good. That makes Dad happy." And I had a smile on my face, and she could tell that I was pleased. And the point I'm trying to establish is that she had to learn to obey. And I would have kept that process up for 30, 40, 50 minutes until Suzanne obeyed. Now let me point out one other thing in this, and that's when you're communicating with a little child, you must have visual contact with them. They must look at you. You must have their eyes. I do not permit the kids when they're that young to let their eyes roll about their head and wander all over the room when I am talking with them. I want them looking at me so that they not only hear my voice, but they see my eyes, and they see my nonverbal cues as well as hearing my verbal cues. Now, from that point on, I wanted to build on Suzanne no, Suzanne yes. I wanted to build on her touching things or not touching things. And so throughout that day and for days after that, as Suzanne would wander around the room, she began at that point wanting to get to the cords. And she would go to this lamp cord, or she would go to that particular cord, and I would watch her, or Janice would watch her, and we would say, "Suzanne, no." And if she stopped, wonderful. We'd praise her for that. If she would not stop but would grab the cord, we would get right over there swiftly and slap her on that hand that grabbed the cord. And then we would continue the process. Let me also point out one other thing. We do not, in the development of children when they're real young, remove objects from their reach. For instance, we don't take things off the coffee table. We don't take the knickknacks off the lower shelves. And our point is that we want to teach the kids what they can do and what they cannot do. And I hear many people say to me, "Well, if you leave everything down like that, it's either number one, going to get destroyed or broken, or number two, most of your training with the children is going to be centered around no, 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 and that's such a negative atmosphere." And personally, I just don't buy that. We've raised our four kids and the foster children we've had, and we have never removed any of those articles from their particular grasp. And we've taught them that you can touch this and you cannot touch that. There are certain things they cannot touch. There are things they can touch. And they learn that, and it does not make them insecure. And it does not focus the teaching in a negative posture. That's just the world they live in, and that's how they learn. Let me continue the illustration with Suzanne. The situation with the feeding dish was about 7 months. The next one where we had a significant issue of will was when she was about 18 months old, right around there. At this point, we've been teaching her to say please. Whenever she would want something, we would say, "Suzanne, say please," and she would say please. And things were going along real well. One night, about 9 o'clock, I was walking to the refrigerator to get a glass of milk, after which I was going to leave the house. I had an appointment in town. As I got the milk out and began to pour it into a glass, Suzanne walked up and said, "Daddy, milk." And I just looked at her and I said, "Suzanne, say milk, please." And she went, "Hmm," and she turned her head on me. And I said, "Suzanne, say milk, please." And she humphed again and she sort of turned away from me and she sort of stomped her foot. And then she started to walk off. And I shut that refrigerator door, put the pitcher of milk down, and I said, "Suzanne, you come here." And I sat down on the floor in the kitchen, and I brought her over to me between my legs, and I stood her there, and I said, "Suzanne, you say milk, please." And at this, she just turned her head and wouldn't look at me. And I reached up, and I turned her little face back to me, and I said, "Suzanne, Daddy says milk, please." And she still wouldn't say it. And so I kept it up. I said, "Suzanne, say milk, please." I'm telling you, that went on for one solid hour, from 9 o'clock until 10 o'clock. Now, there was no need for me to slap her. Had I said, "Suzanne, if you don't say milk, please, I will spank you," I would have followed through with that. But I saw no need to tell her I was going to slap her for not obeying. I was just going to make her stand there until she said, "Milk, please." And we went for 1 hour. During that 1 hour, she got tired. As you can well imagine, it's 9 o'clock in the evening. We're going to 10 o'clock. She began to get tired. She began to want to sit down. I would not let her sit down. She wanted to lean against my legs, and I would not let her lean against my legs. She'd want to lean against me, and I'd say, "No, Suzanne. You stand right there, Suzanne, and you say, 'Milk, please.'" And my friend, we went until 10 o'clock in the evening. Someone came to the door, and they wanted to talk to me. And I said, "Pardon me, but you're going to have to leave. I can't talk with you tonight. I've got to take care of this." And then they left. And at 10 o'clock in the evening, Suzanne looked at me, and she said, "Milk, please." And I said, "Suzanne, very good." And I gave her the milk and made a big deal out of her saying, "Milk, please." My point there was that she was going to obey. When I ask them to do something, they are going to obey. If it has to take me hours, they're going to obey. Now, in the first illustration, I slapped her hand. In the second illustration, I talked with her. Now, let me give you another illustration. This was when Suzanne was about 2, maybe 2 and a half. We had a young lady living with us at that time, and she was doing dishes in the kitchen. I happened to be walking by the kitchen, and just as I walked by, I saw Suzanne walk up to the young lady living with us and slap her on the leg. And I couldn't figure out why. And I saw that, and I said, "Suzanne, you tell Lynn you're sorry." And Suzanne looked at me, and she said, "No." And I said, "Suzanne, you tell Lynn you're sorry." And she said, "No." I said, "Suzanne, either you tell Lynn you're sorry or Daddy is going to spank you." And again she looked at me and she said, "No." Thereupon I walked into that room, took her by the hand, turned her around, and I slapped her 2 or 3 times on her rear end. She started to cry. I said, "Now, Suzanne, you walk over to Lynn and you tell Lynn you're sorry." She looked at me and she said, "No." And I went through that 5 or 6 times. During that period of time, Lynn wanted to get out of the kitchen. And I said, "Lynn, you stand right there until Suzanne tells you she's sorry and we're through." Finally, after that 5th or 6th time, Suzanne walked over to Lynn and said, "Lynn, I'm sorry." And then Lynn forgave her. And then I told Suzanne I was very pleased with her saying she was sorry. And I did not want to see her slap people like that. We just did not do that. And then Lynn runs out of the kitchen crying. Prior to her running out of the kitchen to cry, I had sent Suzanne up to the bedroom then, and I mentioned to Lynn, I said, "Now, Lynn, I want you to remember that the Bible teaches us that no chastening for the present seems to be joyous, but grievous. And going through that little process with Suzanne was not fun. It hurt. It's not joyous. It's grievous. But the Scriptures go on to say, nevertheless, afterward, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who are exercised thereby." And with Suzanne going through that process of righteousness, she was exercised and she learned to do what she was asked to do. She learned to obey, and it yields peaceable fruit in her life. Now, my point through these three illustrations has been that children must be taught to obey, and the will of the child is the key to the process. They must be taught to obey your voice. When you ask them to do something, you need only ask them once. Expect them to obey the first time. Now, let me give you a situation on children obeying your look. How many times have you been out on a social occasion with your children along, and they've been doing something wrong, and you've looked across the room to get their attention, and they knew you were looking, but they would not look at you. And they'd keep their eyes going every other way. Or that you'd look across the room and they would look at you and you'd signal them with your eyes and your head or your mouth. You'd say, "No, do not do that." And they would just smile at you and do it anyway, knowing that you wouldn't make a scene. Now, I would suggest to you that children should obey your look so that in situations like that, you can get visual contact with them. You can maintain visual contact with them, and they will obey you. They will obey the nod of the head, the turn of the head. They will obey what they see you saying with your lips. I'll give you an illustration. In the early years when Janice and I were attending a local church in Carolina, shortly after we got underway for the Lord, I was asked to lead singing in this church during the worship service. And so I was up front leading singing this one morning. My wife was in the choir. Usually when we were both away from the children like that. I had the kids sitting with some dear friends of ours in the church. On this particular occasion, I was leading the singing, and I looked down, and our two oldest, Eric and Amy, were sitting with our friends. Eric was looking up front singing, and Amy was playing with the songbook and making a little commotion down in the pew. And I would look over at Amy, and she would not look up at me. I noticed Eric was nudging her, trying to get her to look up at me, and she would not look up at me. I noticed Eric was trying to get her to behave, and she wouldn't respond. The people she was sitting with were trying to get her to stop playing with the book, and she would not. And this continued for some time, and I kept praying, saying, Lord, make her look at me. Oh, God, make her look at me. And she wouldn't. So finally, I just stopped the singing. I stopped the congregation from singing. And I said, Amy Lewis, look up at me. And she looked up at me. Her eyes got real wide. And I said, Amy Lewis, you know that we do not behave that way when we are in church. When we are in church, we sit upright and we behave. You know that, daughter. I want you to stop, and I want you to be good. Do you understand me? In a real soft voice, she said, yes, sir. And I said, Amy Lewis, I can't hear you. Do you understand me? And she said, yes, sir. And then we continued the singing. Now, I know that many of the saints in the church that morning were offended, and they were upset with me. And I thought, well, now, how sad. It was extremely important for my daughter to learn how to obey and to behave. And if she could get that lesson by virtue of that situation, and it would carry her for the rest of her life, it was valuable to me. And we still laugh about that. She remembers that lesson. Children can be taught to obey your look. Now, it's often occurred to me in Psalm 32, verse 8, where the Lord says, I will guide you with my eye. That we can guide our children with our eye. And I've briefed the kids as they're growing up. Children, when we're out somewhere and you're not sure what to do, I want you to look over at me. Wherever we are, you just look at me and I'll be watching you. And then I'll signal you with my eye to do this or not to do that. I might signal you, I might look at the butter and look at you and look at someone else. And look at the butter and look at you and look at someone else. And by that I mean pick up the butter and pass it to that person. My responsibility as a parent is to have my eye on my children when we're out and to be endeavoring to instruct them with my eye if I cannot instruct them with my voice. And children can learn to respond to that. I make a point, children ought to obey your spirit. There are times when the kids are too young to understand. They can't understand your words yet, but what they do sense is your spirit, and they pick up those nonverbal cues, and they can learn to obey that. And also there are times when you're not around and the kids might just know that, well, you know, Dad wouldn't want me to do that or Mom would want me to do that, and they should obey that prompting. Our objective is to teach the children to obey. They need to learn to obey. And the key to the process is the will. Now, how do you establish whether or not it's an issue of will? And how do you know whether or not you're communicating? Because if you have an issue of will, and if you are communicating, then you must continue until the child obeys, until the child yields to you his or her will. You know, some issues of will are real simple. The child throws something down, and you say to the child, pick that up, please. And the child will not pick it up. And you know you're communicating. The child just maybe rolls its eyes at you or just turns its head as if it's not going to pay you any attention. I suggest to you, at that point, you have an issue of will and you continue until that child obeys. It may be a situation where you have to slap a hand or spank them on the bottom. Or it may be that all you need to do is just keep them there until they do what you want them to do. My point is, when you are communicating and you know it, you have an issue of the will, you get them to obey. You get them to yield their will to you. And as I mentioned earlier, it is crucial for them to learn it at an early age. The earlier they learn it, the easier it is for them as they grow. The longer you take to teach them that, the more difficult it's going to become. And I may have made the point earlier, society is a rough master when it teaches that lesson. Rule number three, Lewis's law number three, the training of the child must center around four-letter words. Words like duty, home, work, save, earn, love, and give. And I'm sure you could add many more to that list, many more of your own choosing. Let me give you another one. Children need to learn to do what they do not like to do, because life is full of a lot of unlikables. And how many times have you heard kids respond to parents when asked to do something, "But I don't like to do that. It's just no fun to do that. I want to go play. I want to go do this. I don't like to do that." Well, that's just tough. There are a lot of things I don't like to do as an adult, but I have to do them. It's part of responsibility. And I just have to learn to do things that I don't like to do. I don't particularly get all excited when I have to stick my hands in a plugged-up toilet to clean the toilet out, but it has to be done. I don't particularly like to clean up vomit when someone's thrown up because they're sick, but somebody has to do it. It's not a likable thing, but it has to be done. Therefore, I would suggest to you that children need to learn to do what they do not like to do, because life is full of a lot of unlikables. Another rule. Children need to learn to enjoy work. Life is going to be full of it. And as you have your kids working around the home on various projects, do not allow them to gripe and mumble and whine and complain. You encourage them to be happy with their work, happy with working. Now, again, example being the best way to teach, I would suggest to you that when you're working in the presence of your kids, you enjoy it. You throw yourself into it. You make it enjoyable. Life is going to be full of work. The sooner they can learn to enjoy work, the better it's going to be for them. Let me suggest another law. Children need to learn that regardless of what transpires, in terms of their conduct, in terms of the course they choose for their life, they're always going to be my children. They're always my kids. Good or bad, they're my children. I'm their father and I love them. I accept them. I might not approve of their conduct, but I do not reject them. They're always my sons and daughters. They may choose a course of life that I don't particularly approve of, but they're still my sons and daughters. They may engage in activities after they leave my home that I'm not particularly fond of, but they're still my children. They're still my sons and they're still my daughters. Children need to learn how to return to the path of righteousness. See, we're so concerned with training up our kids in the way that they should go, training them up in the path of righteousness, we often forget how to teach them how to get back to the path of righteousness, how to get back into fellowship. And how often is it true in our lives when we go astray, how difficult it is for us to swallow our pride, for us to say we're wrong, and to get back on the right track. And so we need to teach the kids how to get back into fellowship, how to get back into fellowship with God when they've sinned, how to get back into fellowship with one another when they've offended one another, how to say, "I'm sorry," how to ask for forgiveness, how to make restitution, how to get back into the path of righteousness. Another law, children need to learn that life involves submission and servanthood. Submission to God and servanthood toward humanity. When we teach our kids to obey when they're very young, later on we're going to teach them how to transfer that same submission to God, how to yield their will to God, and then how to serve humanity. If I give my kids two objectives, it's to love God in the inner man and serve humanity in the outer man. They're responsible, just like David was, to serve their generation by the will of God. Another law. Children need to learn how to receive instruction and how to receive punishment. We talked earlier on praying, what to pray for your kids. Pray that they be teachable. They need to learn how to receive instruction, how to be desirous of having someone else teach them. That's the key to education, is desiring instruction and knowing how to take it. How to be quiet when they need to be quiet. How to ask questions when it's time to ask questions. Develop within them a real hunger to learn. And one of the keys to that is just in your own life, having a real hunger to learn. Being teachable yourself. How to receive instruction. How often have you seen or heard of parents who talk about, "Well, I can't spank old so-and-so, or I can't do this," because they just won't stand still, or when I begin to spank them or correct them, they begin to scream and holler and throw a temper tantrum. And then they just give up. Now, I would suggest to you, you teach your children how to take punishment. If it's in terms of a spanking, or if it's in terms of being quiet, you teach them how to take punishment. I do not let the children dance around when I'm spanking them. I'm either going to lean them across my knee, or I have them bend across the bed, or across a chair, or whatever, and they stand still, and they take it. I teach them how to take their licks like a man or like a woman, or a young boy or a young girl. And if they start to dance around and holler, I say, all right, now stop. We're going to start all over again. And you are going to take this licking without screaming out, without jumping around. If you scream out and if you jump around, we start all over again. And what we've done doesn't count. And again, as I'm talking with them, they're looking at me, and they can tell both verbally and nonverbally that I am serious, that I intend to do what I say. Now, they're allowed to cry. I mentioned this once before. We teach them how to cry softly. When I spank them, Proverbs says, a spanking should hurt. Proverbs 20, verse 30. And when I spank them, those few licks they get will hurt. And they will cry, but they don't scream out in anger and manifest their will in terms of that screaming. And then let me give you one more law. I never let the children develop a habit that we have to break later. And for me, some of the classics are the habit of thumb sucking. I personally am of the persuasion that thumb sucking is just a habit they acquire. I don't think there, as I've heard some people say, well, it's a sucking reflex and they need to satisfy that sucking reflex. I just have a difficult time accepting that personally. And I know pediatricians have said, well, that's the case. So we've taken pictures of the child in the womb and we see the child in the womb with a thumb in its mouth. And I think, I wonder if that just wasn't a fluky picture, a lucky picture, and occurred that way and they got a shot of it and just verified their particular prejudice. And oftentimes I think some of the pediatricians that they state that as, well, it's a need the child has just because they don't know how to help the child break that habit. And so they just yield to it. Another one is the Linus blanket. How many times do you see children walking around that Linus blanket, pulling off the fuzz and stuffing the fuzz in their nose? And it gets so bad that the parents, in order to salvage a Linus blanket, end up cutting it into innumerable pieces and carrying pieces in their purse or whatever, so that wherever they get somewhere and the child begins to get insecure, they give it its Linus blanket and it can suck its thumb and play with that blanket and everything's okay. Mercy. Men and women, you teach your children that security is resident in God Almighty and in you. That's where their security is. And they don't need a Linus blanket to make them secure, and they don't need to suck their thumb to get secure. They just need to learn to respond to you. They need to learn that you are consistent, that you say what you mean, and you mean what you say. And that will bring all kinds of security into their lives. Here's some do nots, some don'ts. Don't compare your children with other kids. Don't scorn or ridicule them. Don't attack their character. Speak to the acts, but don't attack their character. Don't say, you're a liar. Say, you lied. Do not promise them rewards or bribes. Do not discipline when you're angry. And by discipline here, I mean do not punish when you're angry. You get control of your temper. Often what I would do in a situation like this, because they would do some things and I would just get upset, is I would say, you go into the bathroom and you wait for me in there. You go in there and you sit down and you wait for Daddy to come in there. You shut that door and don't you play with the toilet paper, don't you flush the john, you just sit there and wait for Dad to come in. And then I would get control of myself. And once I'm in control of my emotions, then I would go in and talk with them. Don't expect perfection. Your children aren't going to be perfect. You're not perfect. So don't expect perfection from them. Don't be afraid to say no. Don't withdraw your affection. Remember I said you discipline with their conduct, but you accept them and you still love them. And don't shut the door to future progress. Don't say, you'll never change. You're always going to be this way. Let me give you some do's. Do expect your children to obey. When you share things with them, when you ask them to do things, there should be that tone in your voice that you expect them to obey. Praise their good behavior. Have confidence in your ability as a parent. Give responsibility to your child. Teach them to respect privacy, property, and person. Do pray for them. Do realize that discipline is a long-range process, and casualties are essential to growth. Now, just let me give you a couple little other tips. There's some rules that I saw had been laid down for one family. One rule was that the menu at mealtime offers two choices, take it or leave it. Another one was that the management reserves the right to screen your friends. And let me make a point there. You have a responsibility for your children to screen their friends, to interpret the kind of friends they should have. Here's another one. When the sun sets, you come home. Growing things don't flourish in the dark. And what a good guideline for your kids. When the sun sets, you come home. Here's another one. You have to earn everything. Grades, money, trust. Here was their last one. You can be a hero in your own home. Try it. Anyone who brings honor to this house is. Let me conclude by saying that I trust that you'd be highly motivated as parents, that you'd be challenged by the responsibility that God has given you, by the privilege that God has given you, and that you give yourself wholeheartedly to the task, realizing that God Almighty is on your side. He's desirous of teaching you, instructing you, helping you to be a better parent, and He just wants you to embrace your responsibility in that regard.